Welcome to our podcast, Raising the Aviation Bar. A Eurocontrol podcast that explores the stories of the people who are transforming European aviation.
Flight level 310, 2000.
From the ground to the sky.
Hello, my name is Anita Zech. Our guest today is Stephen Moore, Eurocontrol's Head of Air Traffic Management Operations. Stephen runs Eurocontrol's Network Manager Operations Center, our 24/7 operations service that keeps air traffic flowing smoothly across the European network. This episode focuses on one of the big topics in our Eurocontrol 2030 program. How well are we preparing for summer 2023? Thank you for joining us on this podcast, Stephen.
Hello, Anita, and thank you indeed. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Stephen, before we dive into today's subject, let's first talk a bit about you. You started out studying philosophy and then became an air traffic controller, which I think is an interesting combination. Tell us a little bit about your professional journey.
Absolutely. To be or not to be ATC, indeed, is the question. It's a story of love, study, hard work, and eventual following of an aviation hobby that had started much earlier in my life before university, when I became part of the Air Cadets and then got my pilot's license. And then I had an interview, actually, prior to starting university with NATS, the UK ANSP, to become an air traffic controller. And I failed the interview. And I failed on one particular question. I since found out, obviously, having eventually become successful to join. And I failed on the question, really, Mr. Moore, looking at your CV, if British Airways were interviewing next door, you'd rather be in there than in here with us. And I paused before answering, saying, no, that's not the case at all. And I think the interviewer quite clearly realised that at that point, I probably wanted to be a pilot. I'm not sure it was true, and it's certainly not true reflecting back on it, but that was the impression I gave. And so I suddenly realised that my grand plan of becoming an air traffic controller, having applied, wasn't going to happen straight away. And at the time, the company had a policy of you couldn't reapply within a certain time frame. And so I had to decide what I was going to do. And at the time, I was actually studying philosophy in my higher education at school. And I was rather quite good at it, and I enjoyed it greatly. And so I elected to go to King's College London to study philosophy. The reason I chose King's College London, two reasons. One, it's an excellent school of humanities and philosophy. It's a great city. And my girlfriend at the time was going there to study medicine, I think. And so that was obviously where I needed to be. Clearly, we were no longer together after a few months, but that's why I ended up there studying philosophy. And then I applied to join air traffic and was successful. But aviation has always been there. I went on a visit to the Area Control Centre at Manchester when I was probably about 15 or so, and with a friend of a friend of the family, and really enjoyed the time there for a full shift, seeing what the controllers did, and basically it grew from that.
So you always knew that you wanted to work in aviation?
Yeah, I always wanted to do something. I mean, in that sense, I was not the black sheep of the family, but my brother's a doctor, followed a very traditional line. I went a bit wayward left and right and ended up doing something that, you know, very few people know much about, air traffic control, especially in the radar environment. Most people understand air traffic controllers in a control tower, but those behind the scenes controllers that do the work from a radar perspective, most traveling public have no idea what's going on there.
Indeed.
So, yeah.
So you worked as an air traffic controller and also as a trainer, I understand.
Yeah.
And then how come you joined Eurocontrol?
Well, that's a journey that's almost as long in the making as the one about how I ended up doing philosophy in some senses. As you rightly say, became a controller in the London terminal area, and held a validation for 18 plus years. And during that time, I did the normal progression, as I would refer to it. You become a controller, you then become an instructor as a controller as well, then an examiner and so on, and a supervisor for the local sort of area. And then I had an opportunity to help out in the training department, and became the head of training, became the head of competency as well and safety, went back on watch as a watch manager, watch supervisor, and in London Terminal Control, that also includes doing the flow management of the London airspace. So we're talking some of the busiest, most complex airspace in the world, with the five busy airports really close together in about a 25-mile radius of each other. And that was really where I started getting involved in, you know, network management, flow control, admittedly in one small part of the world. It's not, you know, it's not Eurocontrol for sure. And I became a watch supervisor and then had an opportunity and applied for and became a deputy general manager of Swanwick ACC, where I was responsible and accountable for the airspace and no longer at that point held my validation. And it was a natural part of my career in about 2018, 2019 to start looking for other things to do. But I'd never really considered leaving NATS, let alone the country. And if I can just take a sideline as well, it's probably fair to reflect on the reputation that Eurocontrol had 10, 15 years ago when my career was blooming. And the Eurocontrol, with the arrival of the previous DG, the existing DNM, and now our new DG, the reputation is massively different to what it was in a really positive way. You know, we're going to talk, I'm sure, about raising the bar, but this really changed a few years ago. And so at that point, I really started to think, well, maybe there's an opportunity at Eurocontrol. And so we're starting to look. And so when the opportunity arose for the role of the head of the ATM Network Operations Division, I spoke with my senior managers in NATS and had their full support and backing, which I was to this day eternally grateful for. And although there was a long process involved, the rest, as they say, is history. And it seemed, as I say, like the natural progression in my career. But it certainly wasn't planned 20 years ago.
Okay. Now, this is really interesting. And especially since the aviation community is, at the end, it is a small world, so it's always good to retain good relations.
Very small.
As you continue the cooperation in your new role at, well, not so new anymore, but in your role at Eurocontrol. Let's take a little bit of a geopolitical view, because of course there are always many things that are affecting air traffic, which is a global business. The war in Ukraine has not only had a tragic impact on people and the country as a whole, mm-hmm. but it also has had a huge impact on the network. Can you tell us a bit how it has impacted air traffic in Europe and also your team's work?
Okay, so I think first I would reiterate what you've said. The situation was on the 24th of February in 2022 dreadful, and every day has remained dreadful ever since. The effects on the network are considerable. In effect, we have lost 20% of our European aviation network airspace. We've lost about 20% of the airspace by aircraft now not being able to fly over Ukraine for all the obvious reasons, and also in some cases avoiding it to a margin of safety as well. But what that also did was change the traffic patterns in the region. So it's not just about aircraft moving elsewhere and losing 20% of the airspace. It's also about increasing the complexity in those countries to the north and the west and the southwest, indeed, of Ukraine, which has changed the traffic patterns. If you then consider also the effects of the sanctions from the EU as well as from other non-EU member states against operators giving financial succor to Russia and Belarus as well, the traffic flows change yet again. And then on top of that, we have carriers that still operate over Russia, non-European carriers, by European I mean greater than just the EU, by non-European carriers utilising the airspace over Russia and getting almost a competitive advantage over those that are mandated or willingly supporting the sanction regime and avoiding the airspace. So it's a massive amount of complication that isn't really well summed up by just saying we've lost 20% of the airspace. And then finally, before your next question, we've also got the military, and military and NATO are really busy in the neighbouring and adjacent countries, and we can see that from the news as well. And that also adds another layer of complication into the network. So for the ANSPs involved specifically, but also for the airline operators around, and indeed the airports affected, it is really complicated in that area to the west of Ukraine. How it affects us is slightly different. It's stable right now, the situation, and I do not refer to the conflict, I refer to the aviation situation. That is stable. The patterns are now more or less set in stone, and we are learning as a network to adapt to the requirements of the various member states, militaries, and the NATO activities. So in that sense, there's some stability. But it did take some time leading up to the invasion because, let's face it, it wasn't exactly a secret that Russia were planning to invade by the massing of the forces. So a lot of the work had been done in aviation to be prepared should it happen. And so in that sense, it's more straightforward, but it does constrain the network. And as we see the traffic increasing, with that lack of airspace, all of a sudden we're getting pinch points and we're going to find ourselves with the summer ahead with a bit of a challenge, I think, as well there.
So you mentioned that that air traffic is climbing back to pre-pandemic levels, and preparing for the summer traffic is one of Eurocontrol's top priorities at the moment. What are the solutions? I mean, what are we looking at in terms of the situation now that traffic climbs, and what can be done?
So the solutions are primarily now about a great and close collaboration between all of the stakeholders in the network in aviation. There are lots of smaller, lower level practical things that I'll come on to. But at the highest level, we need to engage and have been engaging with all of the stakeholders, the airlines, the airports and the ANSPs, and of course, the Commission where it's relevant and EASA and so on, to make sure that everyone is as prepared as they can be for the summer ahead. So bearing in mind the complexities that we've just discussed as a result of the war, but also the reduction in the available airspace and the predicted levels of traffic this summer, which will reach close to or about 15% above last summer's traffic levels.
So how many flights per day
so
are we talking about?
So that means we could this year, Anita, get to our peak days ever in the network. So in 2019, our busiest day, 37,242 flights, I think. You'll forgive me a small margin there, but around that. And it could be this summer that we peak above 37,500 flights. For more than one day, it could be. Now, there's lots of variations in that, and you know, weather can play a massive impact on that and various other things. But looking purely from the statistics perspective, it is entirely possible that we will breach record days. But record days are one thing. What happens is, you to get to a record day, you generally have a very long period of sustained busy traffic in the network and then occasional peaks above the records. And it's managing that really big sustained period of increased traffic that requires all of the stakeholders to work together. And one of the things we've been doing in the Directorate of Network Management with the stakeholders is spending a lot of time working on and agreeing how we are going to manage this summer. There are four headline areas that all of the stakeholders have agreed to, including us here at the Network Manager, to really focus on to make this summer a success. And if you'll forgive me, I'm going to go through them because they're really important. The
go
first
ahead.
One, thank you. The first one is for all actors involved to prioritise the first rotation to allow for an on-time departure. Statistics vary, but generally it's a vague rule that if you have a one-minute departure delay on the first rotation, by the end of the day for that airframe in a busy summer day, you've created 4 minutes of delay. So 1 minute to four, so fourfold increase in delay. So if you have a 35, 40-minute departure delay on the first rotation for a particular airframe, by the end of the day, that airframe risks being late to a curfew airport, potentially, crew being out of hours because you can pound it up and all of a sudden you're over two and a half hours late on that final rotation. There is very little spare capacity in the system of an airline schedule in the busy summer months to make that time up. Therefore, it's really important to get that first wave out. So all of the actors at the airports, the airlines and the ANSPs and us in the network ops center need to be really focusing on keeping delays to an absolute minimum in that first rotation. The second area that we've all agreed with the stakeholders to focus on is ensuring disciplined flight plan execution. Now, what do we mean by that? As an air traffic controller, it was my honest goal to keep all of the aircraft safe, of course, but to get them to where they were going as quickly as possible, which in parenthesis I could also describe as to get them off my frequency as quickly as possible. And if I could do that by giving them a shortcut, they were happy and I was happy. Now, okay, in London's TMA airspace, it's not a big bit of airspace. It's really short. Some sectors, 35, 40 miles perhaps, longitudinally. But in some of the bigger en route sectors, when you give an aircraft a shortcut, you can absolutely change the downstream or upstream, whichever way you want to look at it, predictability of when that aircraft is going to be in the next or the next but one's person's airspace. Our capacity is managed by understanding the demand from the flight plans and the predicted demand and all the work we're doing in advance with the rolling network ops plans, as well as the immediate demand that we get from the flight plans, against the capacity that we know the ANSPs have. And then if the demand outweighs the capacity, there are various tools to deal with it. But ultimately, we regulate to reduce the traffic to meet the capacity that's available. If I, as an ATCO, am then starting to do lots of shortcuts, or I am in the pilot seat and I'm asking for lots of shortcuts, or I want to go faster than I should at certain times of the phase of the flight, or I want to change the level that I've requested in my flight plan and fly at a different level, I am introducing volatility or a lack of predictability, depending on what your viewpoint of those words is, into the system downstream. And that then leads consequentially to other actions where we as downstream controllers might go, hang on a minute, we're getting too many planes now. We need to put a regulation on. We put on a regulation very late, which causes exponential delay compared to planning ahead. And then tomorrow, you and I are sat down on the radar beside each other and we say, no. We know we're going to get extra planes. Don't care what the system says. So we'll regulate and we'll regulate lower, artificially reducing the available capacity as a result of this. So if everyone can stick to their flight plans, controllers and pilots can stick to their flight plans and fly at the levels and within reason fly along the flight plan routes, obviously with safety as the first and absolute most priority, then the predictability and the confidence returns into the tools and the systems that give us the indication of the traffic that's going to be in the sectors. That was the second one. I've got two more to go. I promise I'll speed up. The third one is for the ANSPs and the airports, particularly, but not exclusively, to deliver the agreed capacities. So if I'm an ANSP and I've said I'm going to give five sectors this morning, just as an argument's sake, I need to do that. And if there's a reason I can't do that, we need to understand as early as possible to deal with that, to make sure that what everyone is planned on in terms of the capacity available is delivered. Of course, at times there are going to be differences, but even then, in any sort of resilience plan, there should be the availability to ensure what capacity has been agreed, be it on the ground, be it in the airspace, is delivered. Of course, things such as weather and unforeseen circumstances can make a change, but generally speaking, we should absolutely be delivering to the stakeholders in the network the agreed capacities from the various relevant parties. And then finally, primarily but not exclusively an airline position is around having realistic schedules, including turnaround times that can be met. Clearly, if you're going to arrive late for whatever reason, it's going to be very difficult to make a tight turnaround of 30, 35 minutes. Equally, though, if you've got a turnaround time of an hour and a half for whatever practical reason, it's very easy to make that. But don't leave early, don't arrive late, because then you're introducing back to that unpredictability that we spoke about a minute ago. So having those realistic schedules, including turnaround times, is also a priority. With those four things, which I'm going to remind the listeners what they are, because I know I've been talking a lot, prioritising the first rotation to allow for that on-time departure, discipline flight plan execution to ensure that predictability, delivering the agreed capacities, and finally, having realistic schedules, including turnaround times. With these four main themes, we believe we are going to have the very best possible summer, considering the restrictions and the problems and the capacity issues that we have generally in the network anyway, where the demand is really high. And in a post-COVID environment, that's really nice to see as well, as a sort of footnote here, that the demand is back. People want to travel, people need to travel, and the airlines are able to very quickly, in an agile way, deliver the capacity from their perspective that's required. And we need to work together to make sure the network can cope.
Okay, No, I think this gives a really good overview of what is expected. What I take from that is really disciplined behavior by all actors in the network, because at the end of the day, one delay in one part of the network affects the other parts of the network. Now, we've talked about that, and I think we're also on a good path of raising awareness for the four priorities you just mentioned. But what about the unexpected things like bad weather or industrial action? Maybe just for our listeners who are not so aware of what is happening at the ops center, can you describe to us what happens when your team needs to find solutions when you, like, at very short notice find out that let's assume it's bad weather?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bad weather is a really good example because it's one of the few things generally that you can't foresee accurately. We all know, we look at the weather on our phone app or on the television or wherever we get our personal information from, and we go, oh, it's going to be sunny tomorrow. And in Belgium, it's never quite true. And so we end up getting wet or whatever. In aviation, it's exactly the same. The best forecasts are within 24, 36 hours at the very most. And even then, convective weather activity, so thunderstorms, and thunderstorms that aren't organized, as in a front of a weather front, can pop up anywhere, especially in the heat of the summer. And so whilst we can imagine, when we look at it from a Northern European perspective, of the hot, balmy, stormy summer nights in the south of Europe, it can happen anywhere depending on the environmental conditions for the weather to build. So even with the best forecasting, there are times in the network where we have unexpected bad weather, and it can cause an awful lot of disruption to the very disciplined way we want to normally execute the network that we've spoken about previously. From the Network Management Operations Centre here in Brussels, in our headquarters, there are various actions that we do. Now, normally, we would hope to find this pre-tactically, so the day before, have an indication that thunderstorms are likely. And in the summer months, we have, with our stakeholders, the ANSPs and the airlines, something called the Cross-Border Weather Group that looks to work collaboratively across nation states to consider a view of the weather and the likelihood and predictability of thunderstorms throughout the summer. And one of the proactive things we do as part of the Network Ops Centre here is to have embedded Met observers with us throughout the summer months over the busy weekends to give us that accurate network view of the forecast and, when the weather arrives, what it's going to do, as best as any qualified Met observer can tell, so that we can adapt and move the traffic flows. When it really bubbles up and no one's expecting it, it is a serious amount of workload that we're experiencing here. We're liaising, the operators in the ops room here are liaising with the ANSPs that are affected. We're liaising with the airlines, offering reroutings, looking at capacities and how we can increase capacities, making sure that when the weather has moved, which generally it does, we're able to reopen or increase the capacities of airspace as best we can, planning ahead. So with the Met forecasters that are here and with the ANSPs, looking at the wind directions, seeing where the weather's going to move, so that we can put on regulations in advance of when they're needed, so that there's a good technical lead time into the start of the regulation period, because that reduces the volatility in the network. If I can give 2 or 3 hours notice of a regulation in the system, it's a much more smooth application and far less delay overall than if I give 5 minutes notice in a knee-jerk fashion of, I've got bad weather, I need to put on a regulation, which causes a massive amount of delay. And then, as I've already indicated, opening up that airspace as soon as we can after the weather has moved on. But it's also liaising with the airlines to find the best, most suitable alternative routings if they're available. If you've got a massive squall line of thunderstorms that can extend 200, 300, 400 nautical miles, it's very difficult to find practical rerouting scenarios that aren't either going to require a refueling stop or maybe a significant amount of additional miles that an airline operator just wouldn't want to take, perhaps. So it's very much an increased workload for us, an increased workload in the network, and of course for the controllers and the pilots as well. But it's all about ensuring the safety of the airspace, the provision of the services in a reliable way, and making sure that we get the aviation network moving as quickly as we can in the area that's affected.
Very good. Very good. I hope you have a very sunny summer, not disrupted by bad weather. In any case, it will be very busy, and I wish you and the team good luck with that. The theme of our podcast is Raising the Aviation Bar. And we're aiming to interview people, as I said earlier, people that are contributing to building the aviation sector of the future. Now, digitalization is something that you cannot avoid anymore these days. It's a development that is transforming not just aviation, but almost all sectors. Eurocontrol itself is investing 300 million euros over a 10-year period to modernize our operational systems. And it's called Integrated Network Management, this program. We like to call it INM, much shorter and nicer. And my question to you would be, how do you think digital transformation will change the work you do?
Wow. First of all, I think it's really worth explaining that INM, Integrated Network Management, is all about critical system upgrades. The systems that we have in the network manager, in the ops center particularly, but around the network as well, are systems that have been conceived, designed, built over many years. And they've been iteratively improved for various reasons, good and really critical reasons over the years as well. So we have a very old baseline of systems which work perfectly, but are, compared to the modern age, less resilient than they might be if they were on a new platform, and less easy to upgrade than if they were changed. That's not to say that all the work that's happened in the past is wrong. It's absolutely not. It's been brilliant, and it is brilliant. And that sets the very foundation for what we're trying to do with INM. Now, I'm no engineer, no technical person at all. You need to find someone that understands all of this detail. But in my simplistic terms, we are going from a... am I allowed to mention brand names here? I don't know. I'm going to anyway. We're going from an old block Motorola-type telephone of the 1980s, the sort of thing you'd see on a Lethal Weapon film with Mel Gibson holding a case with the batteries and all that sort of stuff. We're going from that sort of technology to, I don't know whether you sport an iPhone or an Android, but I've got an Android phone here, to the latest type of Android phone or iPhone. Okay, we are talking about that gulf of technology in the background. But what we're trying to do in the first stage is put our systems on what's called a digital platform. So it's going from the old style tech of a Motorola to the new style tech of Android or iPhone 14 Max or whatever it is, and having that baseline software on platform that is actually much more usable and adaptable for the future. That's the first stage. We have also got a new stage that has necessitated the building of our new ops center here. That's a part of the Integrated Network Management program as well. And the listeners will be able to find far more information about that on our website, I'm sure, in due course, as we plan to open that in readiness for our new system rollout that comes afterwards by the end of this year. So we're going to get onto a new digital platform that will enable us to put our existing systems onto a new platform.
Then, and that will also be for the users, I believe.
Absolutely. That's for everyone in the network. Now, the first part, the part that I've tried in my clumsy, non-technical way to describe, is transparent to the users. So there should be no change. It's in effect the back office, sorting out the back office, getting rid of old Linux stuff. I'm putting it on new modern day platform. Thereafter, we can start the upgrading of the systems. And we're only talking from now, in mid-23, 18 months or so away. Once we've got that first digital platform away, shadow operations by the end of 24, live operations in early 2025. And then we can start with the upgrades of the new parts of the system as they come online, as we need to. Rather like on a phone, you have a new app or you upgrade an app or whatever it may be, that sort of thing, again, from a non-technical perspective. But it's really important for the network, and it's important for the network in many senses, not least, we have to be able to respond to the needs of the stakeholders. So the ANSPs, the airlines, the airports, we have to be able to make sure that the system is resilient for the future, secure by design, future-proof, and able to be updated, adapted as needs be. Right now, we don't have that. And that will allow us to offer the very best service, not just from an operational perspective from our ops center, but also where we give data out B2B from Eurocontrol's information to the network, And importantly, post-operatively, when we're looking into how we can improve things in the network, be it individual events like a bad weather day or industrial action or something like that, how we can improve the forecasting, but also if there's been an issue an over-delivery of traffic, we can work out exactly what happened and how to improve it, as well as do better forecasting and simulations of what's going to happen tomorrow based on the inputs that we know today. As you can tell, I'm actually really excited about it, although I have no technical understanding.
Tell.
I'm really excited about the future.
And it's very clear also on the value that this is going to deliver to aviation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it will continue to deliver. And that's the really important thing. This isn't just a one-shot, woohoo, INM delivered. It will continue to grow and deliver eventually as business as usual, which is really exciting. And so if I think back to one of your very first questions about what inspired me to join Eurocontrol, INM before I joined, and I joined just before COVID started here, INM was very much being spoken about back then. And that is a really key, exciting future for us, not just in my area, my division and the Network Operations Centre, but for Eurocontrol and aviation as a future in Europe. Really exciting. And it bring benefits from just the technical side, but also environmental, sustainability. I mean, it's so wide ranging that I think maybe there's an opportunity for a podcast on that bit particularly. But
absolutely,
I'm sure you'll find someone more qualified for that.
No, absolutely. But I think it's really worth to have your perspective and the perspective of the ops room. So thank you for that. We're slowly coming to the end of our podcast. But for our listeners in the aviation community, what is the one thing you would like them to remember as they're preparing for summer operations?
It's always very difficult when you're asked to limit things to one thing, which I guess is a way of excusing myself for not answering the question in the way you hoped I would by limiting it to one thing. So in support of those four key areas I mentioned earlier around prioritizing the first rotation, disciplined flight plan execution, delivering the agreed capacities and having realistic schedules, including the turnaround times, Eurocontrol and the Network Management Ops Center has produced a guide for helping prepare for the best summer possible this year. And it's something that's happened in previous years, but this year, as you know, we've refreshed it, we've tried to revise it and run past sample groups of the stakeholder areas to make sure we've got all the feedback in to give the best tips for a good summer ahead. And that's called All Together Now. The tagline, if you like, is don't think local, think network. And that's really important. And if there was one thing I would ask for the listeners to bear in mind, yes, we've got those four priority areas. I won't repeat them again because you'll probably kick me. And we've also got the All Together Now guide, but it's the tagline. Don't just think about your own little area. Think about the effect on the network, even if it's not the aviation network, the network of your operators at your airport or your pilots if you're a dispatcher, whatever it may be. And that All Together Now guide breaks down by the roles in the sector, the operational roles in the sector of all the stakeholders, be they ATCOs or dispatchers or pilots, etc. They're all in there to give helpful and relevant tips, but also to be able to access the tips and hints for other areas as well. So obviously have a safe and efficient summer, but please, please, please don't think local, think about the network.
Very good. Thank you, Stephen. It's the All Together Now guide is available on the Eurocontrol website. Thank you, Stephen, for sharing your insights.
Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners for joining. If you like this podcast, make sure you subscribe to the Raising the Aviation Bar podcast series.
Raising the Aviation Bar, from the ground to the sky.